This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My name is Alan Scott, and you found us, the place where government actions come face-to-face with business decisions, online at www.bgov.com and on the air right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. This week, we're taking a look at fracking and some proposed rules from the Bureau of Land Management to regulate hydraulic fracturing on the land it owns. It's a great idea, but is it too late to implement them before that bubble bursts? Senior quantitative analyst Jason Arvello will be here to dissect the topic shortly. But we begin the program with what U.S.-based defense firms are doing in an effort to increase revenue. Over the past few years, it's been no secret, there's been a steady decline in defense spending in the U.S., with sequestration adding, or should I say, taking away food from that pot. Now defense firms are looking overseas for money-making opportunities. Now Bloomberg Government has released International Military Sales. Its author is quantitative analyst Evan Krohn, and he's here with us now.
Thanks for having me.
So your latest analysis entitled International Military Sales, U.S.-based defense contractors may find greener pastures overseas as domestic contracting shrinks is not only a mouthful, but lends itself to the question, is there anything secret or sacred? As these contractors start to look overseas for work, are they being held from working for particular countries?
So there is definitely a list of countries that are you can absolutely not work with. And those are things like state sponsors of terror, and those are well known.
Right.
But outside of that, there's actually a lot of opportunity for selling to other countries. And, you know, I looked across the whole wide range of countries and picked out, you know, a variety of countries that are most interesting and most intriguing for defense contractors. But definitely, there's a wide range of countries they can sell to.
So we're talking upgrading equipment. We're talking sending new equipment, getting countries up and running, yep. preparing their militaries, their infrastructure, cybersecurity. It's not just defense systems, but all things are related to the defense world. Correct?
Right, that's right.
You start off the analysis, which is pretty interesting, the findings themselves, in an era of declining federal contract spending, if I may read your words.
Of course.
U.S.-based defense firms are increasingly looking overseas for revenue opportunities. This analysis has kind of broken it down into various areas, like the U.S. Military exports. What are we talking about that's exporting, and who is it going to?
You know, when I was looking at what kind of materials are being sold, there's you know, some major pieces that kind of stick out. When you hear about the big news stories about companies selling overseas, it tends to be aircraft. It tends to be things like helicopters or cargo planes, or, you know, probably the most sexy of all of them is the fighter jets.
Sure.
So you see a lot of that, but you also see a lot of other sort of less, more mundane stuff. So you see a lot of like radios and equipment, transmission equipment, things like that. But then you also see, combat vehicles, missile systems, all these type of things. And it really runs the gamut of the types of stuff that U.S. contractors can do overseas.
A couple of different ways that have been set up to make this flow of goods happen. Explain them for us, because it's not as simple as just walking up with a credit card and going, hey, you know, Mr. Missile Maker, I'd like to purchase 11 of these, 12 of these. There's no catalog they can go through. Or maybe there is a catalog. I don't know. But there are various procurement methods that they must follow.
That's right. There are two major methods that you can do to sell overseas. The first and the largest is foreign military sales, which is essentially, the Department of Defense selling materials overseas. So the Defense Department will go up to, will respond to a letter of request from some other country that says, hey, I want to buy some planes. So the Defense Department would say, okay, well, let's negotiate some terms. And I will then, as the Defense Department, contract with a U.S.-based firm to actually supply that order. So the government is very much involved and sort of is a broker on both sides.
Sure.
The smaller version, which is more direct, is called direct commercial sales. And that is a situation in which a contractor can respond to, a request from a foreign country you know, directly and sign a contract to export those materials. However, they need to have a license from the State Department and Defense Department to do that. So
obviously we want to be aware of it.
Exactly. So yeah, no, it's all it is all very much, you know, controlled by the government because it's a major piece of foreign policy.
I'm thinking the commercial sale aspect. Mr. Prime Minister receives a catalog in the mail listing ballistic missiles that can be purchased. He calls up an 800 number. And next thing you know, he gets a big FedEx package or UPS. It could be either one.
Exactly.
Containing a bunch of free toys or new toys, I should say.
Yeah,
but that's not exactly the way it's working. Who are the ones that what countries are we talking about that are doing this? Like, give us an example.
Yeah. So So in the report, I list the top 10, importers of U.S. goods and military goods and services. And, you know, the top one in 2011, which is the latest data that I had, was United Arab Emirates. And they were far and away the biggest. And a lot of what they're buying are really planes. What's interesting is, I've been asked before, like, how, you know, do we have restrictions on the type of materials and goods that we can sell overseas? And of course we do. But UAE has actually more advanced F-16s than the United States does. So they are one of the largest importers of these types of things. And we've seen a lot of different types of aircraft purchases from them.
So let's break this down into quadrants or tiers and such. You address them as quadrants, and then we go on to further break them down into tiers. Give me an example of what we're talking about here.
The way we looked at it was looking at it in terms of countries' growth in U.S. military imports and also growth in just domestic defense spending. The idea being countries that have seen growth in U.S. military imports, you know, have proven interest in getting U.S. goods, and also the U.S. government views them as a, you know, worthwhile partner and an acceptable partner. The growth in defense spending then allows you to, potentially means more imports in the future because budgets are going up and, you know, they're looking to buy more stuff.
Sure.
So basically those two axes kind of divided into four. And then we were saying, you know, the top tier ones, the ones that we really think are like primo, targets for these guys is, are the ones we're growing military imports and growing spending. Then second tier was ones that where you see a split, where you saw like, you know, growth in imports, but maybe declining spending and vice versa. And then the lowest tier being the ones that are declining in both.
Are there any countries, I mean, as I look at the ones who are the first tier countries here, Afghanistan, United Arab Emirates, Canada, South Korea, are there any countries on this list that scare you?
Scare me.
Yeah, that are like, wow, you guys want what?
So, it's interesting because
I can tell you I'm a little nervous that Canada has some of our stuff.
I mean, they're close.
They're close.
I mean, what's interesting about this kind of market is that it is so involved with foreign policy.
Right.
So all these countries, you know, have been vetted and and are, are well-known friends in the U.S. And, you know, we have interest in having them be well-equipped.
Right.
I mean, essentially, this is a way to make sure that our friends can do some of this work as well. And so that's why you see countries, in these sort of more volatile regions that you might say, hey, this is a little scary, but really, it's a way for us to exert our influence in these regions.
We're drawing down now.
Absolutely.
In case you hadn't heard it. You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest right now is quantitative analyst Evan Krone, whose analysis, international military sales, U.S.-based defense contractors may find greener pastures overseas as domestic contracting shrinks, discusses just that. But as we make our way through this, one has to sit back and go, what does all of this mean?
Yeah.
Where are we headed with this, and is it going to get better? Will the industry turn around in the U.S. where we don't need to go looking overseas, or is this now a new pond?
Yeah, so it's a really good question. Looking from 2009 to 2011, which was the data points that I was able to find, U.S. defense contracts declined about $15 billion. However, the exports overseas only increased about $2 to $3 billion. So there's, you know, I've received some questions saying, you know, well, is this really the panacea? Is this going to save sort of the domestic defense industry? And I mean, I think it's hard to say. I mean, we haven't seen complete replacement of all these contracts. Then again, not all of them are replaceable. This is an area of growth that potentially can offset some of these declines. But then again, I mean, the declines are substantial, as Bloomberg government has covered the defense sequestration.
It's sure.
They're very substantial.
We're seeing people. I now know personally people who have lost their jobs, not just being furloughed, but lost their jobs because they're subcontractors and their contract's been cut. So where this will end, we don't know. Anything else you'd like us to take away from your analysis?
In about a week or two, there's going to be another analysis coming out that looks specifically at the market for fighters and sort of services related to those fighters overseas. that Rob Levinson and Duncan Amos will be putting out. And the idea is we want to go deeper into some of these markets and say exactly what are they going to be demanding and what can we provide to them. So we'll go even deeper. You know, this was very much an overview looking at sort of where spending and imports are going overall, but we're going to start getting deeper into the types of material of goods and services that we can sell.
Evan, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks a lot, Evan.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. And a U.S. fracking rule proposed May 24th by the Bureau of Land Management comes with good intentions, but it may be a bit too late to truly regulate hydraulic fracturing on land it manages. So says Bloomberg Government senior quantitative analyst Jason Arvella, who joins me now. How are you?
Hi there, Alan.
Glad to have you here. So your analysis entitled Fracking Rule Won't End Oil Boom shows that we're producing an awful lot of federal oil, or oil on federal land, I should say. Last year, you kind of predicted that this would happen. What kind of led you to that assumption?
Right. And so to take a step back a little bit, we've talked about this in the past. The U.S. is really experiencing an oil and gas production renaissance right now. Domestic production of crude is up about 20 to 25%. Over the past 2 years, and natural gas production is up about 5 to 10% over the same time period. So, you know, those benefits are really easy to quantify. You can actually count the number of barrels that are coming out of the ground. More difficult is to associate the costs with that increased production. And I think what the federal government's trying to do right now is to figure out if that increased production is resulting in any kind of public harm, if it's contaminating the water supply, for example, or if it's causing earthquakes that we hear about in the news. And so that's really the reason behind the BLM rule that was proposed, as you said, on May 24th. The federal government really just wants to get ahead of the curve a little bit in terms of being able to protect the public from any potential harm that it might cause.
Is this a case of it being a little too little too late? I mean, this is going to take some time before this actually gets put into place.
Right, and that's a fair point. So the federal government wants to get ahead of the production curve, but in fact, they might just be behind it. And what we've noticed is that any rules proposed by BLM have taken about 2 to 3 years to implement. So even if it were implemented today, which it's not going to be,
right.
the public comment period was extended just yesterday, an extra 60 days. So we're talking about the end of August that the public's going to be able to comment on this rule. And, you know, it's going to take another couple years after that for implementation. So we're really talking about something that's only going to be enacted in 2015 or 2016. Now, what we've seen is that there's a real production boom on federal land right now, and that's occurring primarily because of increased production in New Mexico. Mm-hmm. And we looked at well-level activity in southeast New Mexico where the boom is taking place, and we're able to sort of forecast that boom is not going to go on forever. It's very much a boom-bust cycle.
Sure.
And we're going to predict that that bust is going to occur, if you will, it's more of a stall than anything, is going to occur around 2014, 2015. So it's going to occur before the rule takes place. In other words, the rule will not cause the production curve to sort of bend down. That's going to happen on its own.
We're talking to Jason Arvella. He's the senior qualitative analyst at Bloomberg Government, discussing fracturing and the new Bureau of Land Management proposed rule that recently came down, open for comments now for another 60 days, as Jason just mentioned. And let's dive into some of those proposed rules. I mean, when you look at, and I know previously when we spoke about fracturing and we compared, you know, offshore drilling to fracturing and the benefits and such, there are such strict regulations around offshore drilling, especially when you think about the various disasters we've had, sure. Unfortunately, in the past, the ecosystem is damaged. Here on federal land, onshore, we're talking people. So sure. Some of these rules are well suited, one of which has to do with chemical disclosure.
Right.
What are they going to do about this, or can they skirt this in any way?
Right. So the BLM rule calls for three things. And the first thing, as you mentioned, is chemical disclosure. That's probably the most controversial. What it's asking for is that oil and gas operators disclose the chemicals they use to hydraulically fracture wells. And to disclose that, they would post the chemicals and other ingredients that they're putting into the ground into this Frack Focus, which is an online registry. Mm-hmm. And so the reason that it's controversial is because...
Here's the catch. Go ahead.
A lot of companies consider the chemicals that they put into the ground to be trade secrets.
Aha!
So the reason that, you know, for any reason, for a lot of reasons, you know, companies wouldn't want to give up trade secrets. But, you know, I think we're seeing kind of a move in that direction. Increased transparency. This is happening, you know, throughout the government, and in a lot of its proposals, it's just calling for open disclosure mm-hmm. of a lot of things. And so I think we're seeing that here with the chemical part of it. It's important to realize, though, that 99% of the volume of the fluids that operators inject underground just consists of water and sand. So sand's there to kind of facilitate the flow of oil and gas through wells up to the surface. 99% of the volume is taken care of by those two ingredients. Just 1% is the chemical
additives. The whale oil or baby seal juice or whatever it is they're using that they don't want to disclose.
Diesel gas,
right. That's secondary though, Jason. Come on. Yeah. Work with me here. No, but they can invoke this trade secret thing and not tell anybody what it is. Doesn't that skirt the regulation?
So it's not clear how that's going to play out. And I think we're going to be able to get some clarity through this comment period. A lot of people are going to be focusing on that one part of this issue. Yeah. And rightfully so. You know, in other states that have implemented this kind of rule already, Wyoming, for example, Colorado is another, they have required that operators disclose the chemicals they use, and they've actually been compliant with it. If you ask oil and gas operators in those states about complying with the rule, they say, it's fine. You know, it's just what we do to take care of business. So... you know, I think right now there's kind of an uproar
about what to do about nothing.
Right. Yeah. Eventually, you know, we're going to shift probably in that direction. And granted, there might be instances where trade secrets are warranted. But for the vast majority of wells, it seems to be the case that oil and gas operators themselves are compliant with that kind of rule.
Yeah. You ask the Bush's beans guy what's in his beans, and he's not going to tell you. The dog's not talking either.
Right.
So why would these guys – I mean, if I had a trade secret of some sort, I don't know that I would be willing to disclose it unless everybody else was doing the same. And I take a look at my ingredients. If they're vastly different from the sand and diesel and water than everyone else is using, I might second guess it because other people may be able to produce what I'm producing, especially if I'm a high performer.
Sure.
So
and so the devil there is going to be in the details, as it usually is. You know, I think we're going to see if it's just chemical disclosure broadly, maybe that's not so harmful to trade secret. But if they're asking for the exact chemical composition, you know, the percentage of one fuel versus another, you know, that's where I think we're going to get into a little bit of gray area. And that's what oil and gas operators might actually push back on.
So it's a three-pronged approach that they're taking. Chemical disclosure is the first of which, wellborne integrity and wastewater management. Tell me a little bit about the wellborne integrity, which makes sense.
Right. So fracking involves shooting liquids, as we've discussed, kind of at very high pressure underground to free up trapped oil and gas. And in order to shoot that liquid underground, they want to make sure that the casing, essentially the pipe in the middle of the well, is able to withstand that kind of high pressure. So the BLM is calling for oil and gas operators to be able to conduct tests beforehand, showing that, yes, in fact, these wells are up to code and you can, in fact, hydraulically fracture them. That's probably the most expensive part of this rule. I think it would account for about 80 to 90% of the cost estimates that BLM gives per well. So I think the BLM was estimating $3,000 to $5,000 in compliance costs for each well drilled if they want to comply with this rule. And about 80 to 90% of that cost would just be borne by the wellbore integrity measure.
This is kind of your anti-earthquake measure, so to speak.
Right. I mean, and this is also making sure that, you know, the fluids that are injected underground don't then leak into the groundwater supply. So, you know, it's talking about the tremor part. It's talking about just water contamination, and it's talking about people, as you mentioned, and people are really concerned that, yes, we do have these benefits that we've quantified before, but what about the costs? And we just want to make sure that we're doing it the right way before we do it.
Well, God forbid there's an accident, I would think that the cost could be defrayed by the potential lifetime movie you can get out of it. But that's just my opinion. Wastewater management, another big one, which is talk about lifetime movies.
right. All three of these things. Yeah. So the wastewater management, a lot of some of the fluids that are injected underground actually resurface.
Right.
And there's the notion that those fluids need to be kind of securely placed, you know, into a lined pit or a storage tank area, and then properly treated and disposed of. Mm-hmm. If they're just flowing back to the surface, it's not clear what that could do then to the groundwater supply again.
Right. Sequester the water, so to speak.
Right.
The fluids, because it's more than just water. Let's take a look at the comparison. I kind of mentioned it a minute ago, of offshore drilling versus this fracturing that's going on now and these proposed rules around it. As we reach the pinnacle, so to speak, of the fracturing world in the on the Bureau of Land and Management, land that is, are we now at a place where we are producing as much as we could do offshore? How are we doing in that respect?
Right. So a few points. This BLM rule only applies to onshore federal land.
Understood.
Doesn't apply to offshore.
Correct.
And that's going to be another question too, because you know we did see with the BP the oil spill that you know you might want to call for additional safeguards against that happening again. So whether or not we're going to see it offshore is one question. Another question is, what about production? Is this going to stall production? Onshore oil accounts for about 5% of U.S. production overall, so it's
really
not that much.
Okay.
It's really the offshore universe that produces quite a bit, and that's about 25% of all oil comes from the Gulf of Mexico. So, you know, I think to your point, the question is going to be, are we going to then see the BOEM, you know, implement this same kind of rule for offshore oil and gas wells? And, you know, I think that's where we could see a real impact on production.
Could definitely stall it as they try to meet the regulations.
Sure.
Although one would think after the BP disaster, obviously lots of rules and regulations went into place there, and BP is still paying penance. You see the commercials all the time come to the Gulf. And as you cruise down the Mississippi River out into the Gulf of Mexico, you see these offshore wells. They're peppering the water like mushrooms.
Yeah.
So I guess I can understand why we're getting more production out of there.
And I think they reached a mile mark yesterday in terms of cleaning up the spill. I think they're officially finished with it. Yeah,
two years
after the fact.
I'm looking forward to going down and taking a look myself. I'll let you know.
Yeah.
Jason, is there anything else you'd like us to take away from this analysis that you've done?
A lot of people are questioning why this rule, why now? And Secretary Jewell, I think, has offered a very articulate reason for that happening. And so hydraulic fracturing, there's nothing new about regulating that on federal lands. The first rules were actually implemented in 1982. Secretary Jewell, though, refers to those as Sony Walkman-era rules and says, by implication, that they need to be upgraded to the iPod era. And I think that's kind of what we're seeing right now to account for the new technologies that have come about over the past few years. We, in turn, need to kind of update the old rules that are currently in place.
Fracking rule won't end oil boom. That's the name of the analysis. His name is Jason Arvelo, senior quantitative analyst with Bloomberg Government. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Follow us on Twitter at BGov. Follow me at Alan L. Scott. We'll be back next Thursday at 11 with plenty more to say about the business impact of government actions. For BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, I'm Alan Scott.